Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Jeanies, welcome back to Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your Radio Roots sleuth on the show where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Well, this week's show is a little different. Not a lot of stories this week because we have as our special guest today, Dennis Brimhall. He is the president and CEO of Family Search International. He was a keynote speaker at Roots Tech. He's a driving force in making our researching easier and easier, better and better. He is right in the middle of partnerships with MyHeritage.com, Ancestry.com, and FindMyPast.com that are bringing us more digital records from around the world than has ever been available in history. How did we get to this amazing place? Where are we going over the next several years? And in the long run, Dennis Brimhall, one of the great visionaries in family history, will tell us in our first of two segments in about 8 minutes. You will be astonished at what he has to say. Then Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com, returns with advice on dealing with damaged documents. Good advice coming later in the show. Well, Jeanies, I have had an incredible privilege and opportunity the past 3 weeks to assist authorities in Utah in finding and bringing closure to living family members of a murder victim. She died in 1983, and her remains were only recently discovered. On Wednesday, we finally got the breakthrough we were looking for. There are still some things that have to happen before this part of the story is complete, and I will share lots more with you about it in the next week or two, when I hope to introduce you to one of her high school classmates who has done so much in preparation to assist the family and honor her memory. This person has been of no small assistance to me in finding the next of kin. It's an emotional story, and when the time is right, there will be much more to tell. Well, I am flummoxed. Yes, flummoxed at the response to last week's show and all the stories it contained. And I got to admit, it was right up there with any episode of Extreme Jeans we have ever aired. Certainly highlighted by Stan Lindis's review of the life of a revolutionary soldier from that man's soldier's pension application. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeJeans.com. The Telegraph of London has published a terrific article on one British genie who hit a brick wall and researching someone who she wasn't even related to. Tess Bowes was working on a book about English housekeepers when she was sifting through some letters at the Sutherland Collection in Stafford. Well, in the pile, she found a record that told her about a woman named Dorothy Dore. Now, Dorothy was the head housekeeper to the Duke and Duchess of Sutherland for some 14 years, from 1818 to 1832, certainly a very high position within a household. Think Downton Abbey. Dorothy made a great mistake in her service. She got pregnant by her husband. Well, naturally, the lady of the household wanted her out. And in an emotional handwritten letter, Dorothy begged the family for 6 weeks' leave to have the child, and then she would find someone to nurse the baby so she could work without distraction. As she became more and more desperate, Dorothy Dore began to steal from the store cupboards. She hoarded all kinds of things, from dusters to soap to tablecloths and sweet wine. And when it was all discovered, Dorothy Dore was out. Well, naturally, Tess needed to know what happened to her. Neither the first year of the English Civil Registration in 1837 nor the first English census of 1841 showed anything concerning her. She looked through all kinds of other records, workhouse, emigration, parish registers, nothing. Tess became as frustrated with not being able to find what happened to Dorothy Dore as she would have had it been one of her own ancestors. Dorothy was lost to history. Well, 3 years passed, and Tess gave a talk on the sad story of the housekeeper who was sacked for the crime of becoming pregnant by her own husband. Well, someone in the audience became intrigued, too, and did something about it. What did she find, and how did she find it? Read the story now. Link to ExtremeJeans.com. I know, I am bad. We have talked about this before, the remarkable study of a virtually isolated population, the people of Iceland. Well, the results are out, with the biggest set of full genomes ever known from one population. A private company called Decode Genetics has gathered data that shows genes that yield new disease risks as well as a lengthy list of over 1,000 genes that we really don't need. It is hoped that this project is used as a model for other countries to do the same. We here in the U.S. can soon expect a similar study of a million of our fellow citizens over the last part of the coming decade, with the hope of using the information to come up with individualized treatments for various maladies. One of the big finds of the Iceland study was of the mutation of one gene whose presence signifies the doubling of the risk for Alzheimer's among those of us with European ancestry. In Le Sueur, Minnesota, Barbara Schwartz planted a lovely front yard garden for some 20 years. Well, last spring, Barb was tilling it and ripped out of the ground a little piece of metal, which she flicked aside. And then when she went to plant, she ran into it again and tossed it aside. Well, when picking time came in August, once again it got in the way, so she brought it into the house and placed it on a shelf. Well, once in the house, Barb's father-in-law, Donald Schwartz, and his brother, Daryl Schwartz, took a closer look at it. They cleaned it up and discovered it was a World War I dog tag from a man named Gilbert Denfield. It noted his enlistment date, his date of birth, and serial number. And with the help of a veteran service officer, the Schwartz took the next step and located Denfield's grave in South Dakota, and through the cemetery received a copy of his obituary. Since Barb's mother-in-law was very much into family history research, Barb decided to take a crack at it herself, eventually locating Sharon Baker of Bend, Oregon, one of Denfield's grandchildren. The Schwartzes are planning to send the tag to Sharon, who will then pass it to her brother, Gilbert. And isn't that the way we like things to happen? Find something, research it, find the right place for it to go, and give it to them. It's a great feeling whether you're on the receiving end or the sending end. I've been fortunate to experience both, meeting many great people over the years. And coming up next, he is a true visionary in the growth of digitized family history materials and so much more. He is the CEO and president of Family Search International, Dennis Brimhall. How is all this new information coming to us with such speed, and what can we expect over the next few years? Dennis will fill us in coming up next in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show.
And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, with a very special guest today. He is the president and CEO of Family Search International, Dennis Brimhall. Dennis, it is just an honor to have you here.
Thank you. It's fun to be here. I love talking about this, so it's a great opportunity.
Well, you know, I saw that at Roots Tech with your presentation and your keynote address, and I remember hearing you talk about how you had left your business in the past. You were a hospital administrator. You wound up in this opportunity, and you went on to get those little letters after your name to become a professional genealogist.
Well, I want to be very cautious. I'm not a professional genealogist, but I decided that if I were going to do this, I probably ought to have some training, so I enrolled in the BYU Idaho course to get a degree in family history, and I'm now taking the courses online and working through that process to see if I can't get a little bit of credential.
Well, and I'm sure it helps, because you were
really
probably
helps.
A very busy man back in the hospital days,
yeah.
Not doing a lot of family history research at that time. But a year ago, we were doing the Roots Tech Media Night, and you did a handout, which was fantastic. It talked about the preservation of documents over the last, century and a half. Now, Family Search is a portion of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which has the big vault in the side of the mountain. And in there are all the records that have been gathered by generations of members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And as a result, we have seen a great access. Of course, the church has become famous for their family history library, and a lot of these records are available there, but not necessarily available in digital form. And you set that as a goal, to get those records in digital form and spread throughout the world, and some partnerships. And let's go through some of these numbers here.
I mean,
they're pretty incredible. I mean, there's an estimated 5.3 billion records that you had from all these different regions on a map. And you were estimating there were 10 billion more. And the time that it was going to take to digitize these was like a generation or more.
It was an interesting thing. Back about 120 years ago, the church decided it was important to start collecting records and to provide families the ability to connect together over generations. And then it was about 90 years ago that the technology started to become available to start doing that. And so we sent camera crews out with microfilm cameras. into archives all over the world for the purpose of microfilming these records. And we'd get the microfilm and bring it back here, develop it, and to store it in a place that would be safe, we built these vaults in the mountains up out of Salt Lake City. And we stored these microfilm records in the vaults. And then if people wanted to see them, they would send an order in, and we'd get a record, and we'd copy it and send the microfilm out to them. And sometimes we have big collections outside the United States, so we don't have to ship everything from here, such as in Germany and places like that. But what happened was we collected these records, but getting them to the people to see them was so awkward because it required a physical duplication and sending microfilms. Well, of course, with the advent of the computer and digital imaging, we began to say, okay, we're going to do two things. First of all, we're going to quit taking microfilm pictures. We're going to take digital pictures. So we replaced all our microfilm cameras with digital cameras, and that allows us to capture the image digitally to begin with. Then we went to all of the rolls of microfilm we have in our vaults. That's about 2.4 million rolls of microfilm. We said, okay, how do we convert a microfilm to a digital image? And we developed some equipment where you can put the microfilm rolls on a scanner, and it, in 4 minutes, it runs the roll through the scanner and creates one 80-gigabyte picture. It's one picture 80 gigabytes big. Then the computer will take it and divide it into pages. Then we do some quality control on it, and now you can publish that online, and people can see the image online as opposed to having to see the microfilm. Now, we've done about 30% of the microfilm in the vault has been digitized or a digital copies made, but we expect within the next couple of years, and we used to think it would take 50 years to get all that done, but with technology and everything else, we expect within the next roughly 2 years, we will have all of the vault completely in digital format, with a rare exception of some where the rights to it never didn't allow us to make digital copies, and we'll respect those rights and they'll stay in a microfilm. Well, that's only part of the process because you still have to look at these images. So what we are now in the process of doing is having volunteers look at the digital image and type into the computer what they see on the screen. So if they see a census record that has John Jeffries as the head of the family, is only a picture of it. But they see that, and they can literally enter that in the computer, and now it's indexed, what we call indexed, which
searchable.
Means it can be searchable.
Right.
And so we have about 300,000 volunteers who do this every day, and every single day we index, which means make available for searching 1.3 million names.
That's unbelievable.
Every day.
And all of these volunteers, they're not necessarily members of the church. They can be from any place in the world. And they go about finding out how to read the strange handwriting. I mean, I remember the first time I had to work with old German language writing, and it was like a child's scribble to me. I couldn't make out anything of that. But I did learn one thing, that when you work at it enough, your eyes begin to adjust.
Right.
And suddenly you can see the words that you wouldn't see
otherwise.
Well,
we do have volunteers. Because we're imaging in Italy, we've got imaging projects. We're imaging at the request and of the contract with the Italian government. We're imaging 480 million Italian civil records. And so we look for Italian people to index. And so the indexing volunteers, and then we get them from everywhere in the world. We were in the Samoa a few weeks ago, and there's Samoan kids doing indexing in Samoan languages. And so we do that. Now, the problem is that indexing is the bottleneck. And so we are beginning to find available to us technology which can begin to automate some of the indexing so people don't have to look at it and do it. And it's amazing where some of that technology is coming from that allows us to do this. And so we're beginning to find technology that can take some of the indexing burden off of us and do it much, much faster.
So how reliable is that technology at this point?
Well, we test it. And so let me give you an example. If you have your phone and you take a picture of somebody, it will look at the person's face, recognize that face, and search through all of your images to find any place where that face is there. It's facial recognition technology. It's quite common and used. Well, we're beginning to explore and doing some research with some universities to try to figure out, can you take facial recognition and apply it to a word? So imagine a word is the face now.
Right, right.
And so you may find an old German Heinrich. So it looks at Heinrich. It's not a face. It's a word, but it uses the same technology. And you can go through 10,000 records and pull up every word that looks like Heinrich. So what you do now is you go and you send, okay, it's pulled up 500 matches. You go through that and say, yes, this is a match, though it isn't. And you do that, and it gets smarter and smarter and smarter. So on certain fields, such as a field that gives male or female or gives age or gives birth dates or dates or things like that, we can get that accuracy up over 90%.
Wow. indexing, to be better than that, though.
Yeah, indexing accuracy is because we index it twice and have it arbitrated. So somebody checks the two. If there's a disagreement, somebody makes a decision. That accuracy is over 97 to 98%. But we, in certain areas, we can get the accuracy to come pretty close to that. Well, you can imagine if an indexer doesn't have to do certain fields, it's done automatically for them, then we can improve the efficiency of indexing dramatically. And so there's some technology that's coming our way that's going to really improve how well, how fast we can do this.
So if I'm looking for, like you mentioned, your Heinrich, would the technology allow us then to find Henrik, Henry, Heinrich, you know, that type of thing?
It can do. The technology can say, okay, we found something that's a perfect match. We can find something that's almost a match. You decide whether you want to include it or not. So that is a combination of technology and the human eye. And so it's not an either or. It's never, oh, it's all technology or all human. It's the combination of the two that will get us closer. And the nice thing about the technology is you can train it to do any language of any era.
Wow.
It doesn't care what language it is. So if you go to Uzbekistan and use Uzbekistanese, I don't know what that's really called, but it doesn't really care. You can train it to do any language. It doesn't matter. So we're in the infancy of this, but we see if we progress in this technology, the way all technology progresses, it's only a matter of years before we've got the accuracy up where it needs to be, and we'll be able to start doing this. We have another technology we call RoboKeen, which takes obituaries, and it knows kind of certain languages, and it will say how an obituary is laid out, because it'll say born in or born or something, and after that is usually a date. The RoboKeen looks at those things and kind of, through artificial intelligence, kind of calculates what that is, and we can get some of that up to about 95, 97% accuracy. But that's in typed format. It's different than handwriting, but you know, we got to do it all, so it's just a matter of getting the technology that works for the problem.
Is there a level where you say, this just isn't quite good enough yet, or where you say, I'm close enough, maybe 3 or 4% less than what people would do, we're going to get so much good stuff from it, we're going to move forward anyway?
Yeah, we have a little saying, don't let perfection be the enemy of good.
Right.
And so
love it.
Yeah, what we want to do is at some point we'll say it's close enough with some disclaimers and some help that we can send it out. Now, one of the things we're going to be doing is we're going to be doing what we call indexing on the fly. See, right now, people index in batches. We send them a batch and they index it. But what if you found a record and you really like the record? And we say, oh, by the way, now that you've found the record, why don't you take a minute to index it? And so it's instead of 300,000 people doing it, it's 2 million people doing it when they found it. And they've been to the record anyway. They've studied the record over because their family's in the record. And we say, oh, wait, while you're here, why don't you just index this? And so we're testing that out, and we find that people like to do that. And that's going to bring a big dividend to us as well.
Well, it's their people too,
it's
right?
It's their people.
I mean, that makes a big difference.
Yeah.
We're talking to Dennis Brimhall. He is the president and CEO of Family Search International. And when we return, Dennis, let's talk about the future, the partnerships that are going on right now with Family Search that are really moving things forward. On Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Welcome back. It's Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Dennis Brimhall. He is the president and CEO of Family Search International. And Dennis, once again, thanks so much for coming and spending some of your valuable time with us. You are a leader right now in putting together some partnerships that just are unbelievable. We've got MyHeritage, we've got Ancestry.com, we've got Find My Past, and now they're working in terms of what they call frenemies. and I like that term because it means they're working together and there's a recognition that no one entity, including Family Search, can get it all. And so now you're all working together in certain ways. Let's talk about those partnerships, how those have come together, and what you see as the future of the partnerships and what that's going to be bringing us, say, over the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, thank you. We are very excited about this because we've been at this, again, for 120 years and offer it free. We have limited resources. We rely heavily upon volunteers, but there's a limit to how much we can get done, and there's so much to do. And what we found is that there are people who do what we do, and they do it very, very well. And so you have people who are admittedly in the commercial side of this thing, which we commend and we're glad. They offer to their customers, to their patrons, a service that they charge for, which allows them to get involved in family history. Probably the three biggest ones are Ancestry.com, which is here in the United States, Find My Past, which is out of London, and My Heritage, which is out of Israel. So we simply went to these people who have the same values and the same purpose that we do, And we said, let's not compete. Let's work together. And so why don't we share records? Let's share our records with you, and you share your records with us, and then we'll figure out a way to not compete and not duplicate records, not go after the same record sets, and make these things available. And we recognize they have to make money to exist. We want them to. We don't want to take their business away from them in any way. But we want to also, where appropriate, make records available free to people so that more records are available. That's our goal. More records available, right. More people searching. And so it was a very, very simple thing when we met with the CEOs of these companies to say, let's work out a deal. No resistance at all. Everybody said, of course we'll do this. And so what we've been doing now over the last really 12 to 18 months is we've been able to work with these colleagues and basically say, let's integrate our data and our trees, and let's make things searchable in a way that you can go to kind of one place. And we don't really care where a person goes to. If a person has a better experience on Ancestry than on Family Search, we don't care. We're not making money on this thing. Right. So we just want people to go wherever they can find the records and build their family tree. Once you enter into a partnership where you don't have any pride of ownership or proprietary interest to succeed over somebody else, it's amazing what you can do.
Right.
And that's the basis of this. And so now we then work to where we have partnerships. And so we don't only share data, but they said, listen, we're quite interested in getting another record set in a country. So they may say there's some records in Germany that we'd like to get on Ancestry. You're good at capturing records. You have these camera crews and volunteers who do that. Why don't we provide you some resources? You get that, bring them in. We'll pay to have them indexed so that they get done faster. And then we'll put them up on our line behind our paywall, but for certain customers of Family Search, usually the members of the church who support Family Search, they'll get access to them free. And that way you get significantly more records coming up that we would have never had before. And so it's really one of those 2 + 2 = 5. It's just a great deal. We're very excited about what these partnerships are doing.
I think most of us are, just to watch it and see the development of it. Not only the more records that are coming out, but you're also swapping technology.
We are. We found that, and I must say, I commend, we have some terrific engineers. They do a great job. But everybody's good at different things. And so sometimes we'll send our engineers. We send a bunch of our engineers over to Israel to meet with their engineers. And we always have worked really closely with Ancestry because they're just down the road. But, you know, we found that we're sharing technology and learning from each other and having things. I mean, Ancestry really pioneered some of the work with shaky leaf, what they call shaky leaf. We call it hinting. And so we've learned some things about how we can do that. And MyHeritage has some pretty good stuff on search and match technology. And
it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Of course, we're the masters at records and acquiring records and getting them quality checked and online. And then Find My Passwords and some wonderful things with the whole area of newspaper archives and getting access to the British newspaper collections over the years, which we would never be able to do that. And so if you take the best of everybody and you bring them together, you end up with, you know, 2 + 2 + 2 = 14 or something, as opposed to everybody kind of doing their own thing.
So would you say the focus is on 1500 up to the current time, or do you see a lot of interest in pre-1500 records?
Well, there is a lot of interest in pre-1500 records, but there's a lot of skepticism about the quality and value of those records. So from our standpoint, we want people to search their records back as far as they go. But when people start getting to pre-1500s, we're a little more cautious about the quality of that, because prior to that time, with some exceptions, a lot of those records were kind of put together for the purpose of connecting into certain families to get access to land, and a lot of it was fabricated. So we're a little bit cautious about 1500. Now, 1500 was when people started really writing stuff down and collections were kept and everything else. You go 1500 and it was really only a few people who collected records. Now, that's different in the Chinese records. They have elegant records back thousands of years, elegant, really accurate records, but they're narrow. They're oldest son to oldest son, and they're not very broad. So we look at record sets around the world and we find out what are strengths and weaknesses, and we just acknowledge those. We just acknowledge that there are strengths and weaknesses in those. And one of the things in kind of our Anglo-Saxon Western culture is that pre-1500s, it's a little harder to really document and be accurate on that. Now, in the future, we're not going to be as concerned about archival records. So our great-grandchildren will not be worried much about 1600 records. Our great-grandchildren are going to be worried about the records we're collecting today. And those records tend to be living memory and digital.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're moving out of an archival area into a digital area as we think about who will be using this, you know, 4 or 5 generations from now. So we really have to not be just so focused on archival records that we forget that much of the data today is born digital. we've kind of closed the archival period. We're really kind of into a digital period, and we have to bridge the two as we go forward.
Which means we all kind of benefit from the archives in the now because we all have access.
Right.
And so we preserve what's happening. I think a lot of people forget that we are part of the family history, that, you know, we're going to have that dash between two dates eventually as well. And our story is going to matter to our descendants just as much as our ancestors' stories are important to us.
Well, we have a saying, what will our great-great-grandchildren wish we would have done? Now, they certainly are going to know name, dates, and places. But just like we always say, I wish my great-great-grandfather would have just recorded one more bit of information. Every genealogist says that.
Yes.
But our great-great-great-grandchildren are going to say the same thing. Why didn't you had cameras? Why didn't you keep pictures? Well, we keep pictures. We have so many pictures. We add thousands of pictures a week to the website. And so we just want to be able to take advantage of the culture today and make sure we preserve that, the stories, the photos, the relationships, in a different way than our ancestors did, and accommodate what our great-great-grandchildren are going to wish we would have done.
So how many records are out there, and how long is it going to take to ever gather them all, say, from 1950 on back? Because we're thinking big here, right?
Yeah, it's a debatable number, but we calculate that there's somewhere, give or take, billions, 100 billion people lived on the earth. We think that probably about of the 100 billion people that live, there's probably records that exist on about 10 billion of those.
And are they linkable?
Well, it's a good question. We calculate that the average person has about 6 records.
Hmm.
And so if you say there's 60 billion records out there, and maybe we've got 10 billion of these that we've got today, I mean, we've got a lot of work to do. But we have a plan. I mean, we know how to do it. It's not a matter of that we don't know
right.
how to do it. But you have to find the records. You have to get the digital rights to them. Then you have to image them and index them and all that kind of things. But we know where the records are. We have a very sophisticated way of acquiring records and getting rights. It won't happen on my watch.
Or your grandchild's watch, probably.
But we know we have the plan. We see
sure.
the plan. We see the image. We know what we need to do. As long as we remember that the archival records is one group, but the current born digital is something that we have to be focused on at the same time. So we have to be able to not only look at the past, but the present as we plan for the future.
Dennis, this is a conversation that I wish we could continue for another hour or two or five, because there is so much ground to cover. But thank you so much for your time and sharing with us your vision for where this is all going, because it is an amazing era we're in family history.
It is. There's nothing like it. And people love family history, and now they can do it with ease and comfort and excitement. They can discover themselves. Family history is creating the museum of me, and every ancestor is an exhibit in your museum.
Hey, let's see gardening do this, you know? He's Dennis Brimhall. He's the president and CEO of Family Search International. Thanks so much, Dennis.
Thank you.
We are back. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com. Hi, Tommy. How are you?
Pretty good, thank you.
Well, we're going to talk about damaged materials today, damaged documents and photographs. What happens when you have a flood? And, you know, there's a lot of experience Americans have had in this area in the last many years, going back even to Katrina. Are there ways to recover and restore documents that have been damaged by water?
Oh, yes. There's a lot of things. Yeah, we had a lot of people come into us after Katrina that send us things that had been damaged. The best way to restore documents is not to get them in a position where they need to be restored.
Right.
You know, you can buy fireproof and waterproof safes for under $100 now, and it's the best investment you will ever make.
Can I make a comment on that, though?
Oh, please.
Back in 2001, we had a 1-in-a-500-year rain shower, and it flooded our basement. And I had some very valuable documents in a fireproof safe. I learned fireproof does not mean waterproof.
Exactly.
And some of my my treasures that had to do with a collection of historical documents were damaged severely. And so don't confuse the two. Fireproof will not protect you from water.
Exactly. And the way that that works is there's a special chemical inside the safe that when it gets hot, it seals the safe. So if it's not getting hot, it's just getting wet. That chemical doesn't come out and seal the safe, so the water's going to get in. So what you can do if you want to be very careful is what I do is I have a fireproof safe that I can lock, and I put it inside what's called a Pelican case. It's a big plastic case. It's made for putting camera gear in, but they will actually float.
Really?
They're waterproof. I've tested them. I've done all kinds of things with them, and they won't leak. So you can go on the internet, Amazon.com or whatever, and buy a Pelican case. Make sure it's one of the ones that is watertight. and then put the safe inside that. It's a hard case. It's made out of hard plastic, and they have these clamps that clamp down, and there's a sealer in between them, almost like a giant Tupperware that will seal it and keep the water out. If you have a fire, the Pelican case is probably going to melt, but it doesn't matter. Your fireproof safe is inside. If it just floods, you take it out, you open it up, and your fireproof safe is inside there fine. So it's kind of like killing two birds with one stone, so to speak. That's the best way to do it. They float. So even if you have a bad flood where your house is totally destroyed, maybe somebody six blocks from you will find this Pelican case. So you want to make sure, it's just like you're shipping something, you have a label with your phone number or address inside a Ziploc bag inside the Pelican case, and then also one inside the fireproof safe. Because you never know where these things are going to end up. Your house burns down. They take away all the debris. You never find your safe. Then somebody in a junkyard or someplace finds this thing. Hey, what's this? And breaks it open. And they see all these documents. Who do they belong to?
And by the way, these things really do happen. I never imagined in my wildest dreams we'd have a flood in our home. We're on a mountainside.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you don't get floods there. But we did. It was crazy.
We had some people not far from us. We live on a mountainside also. And a great big huge water tank ruptured, and it flooded everybody downstream from that. So you could have mudslides if you have a fire and there's nothing there to hold. There's so many different ways you can do that. Now, if that's already happened to you, there's some things I want to tell you not to do.
And we're talking about the unthinkable, and that is fire and flood. And what happens to documents that have been damaged? What can be restored? Obviously, flooding is a little more forgiving than fire, Tom. Am I right?
In certain circumstances, you are correct. Usually only the time a fire situation is better than a flooding situation is with old-fashioned film and videotape.
Really?
Yeah, the reason for that is a lot of times the flash point with film and videotape is a lot higher than you would think it is. This two-year-old got his parents' wedding video and put it in the oven, and mom, not knowing it was in there, turned on the oven to preheat it 350 degrees and started smelling something. Opened up the door, and she could see the videotape in there and the smoke. And so she pulled it out, of course, and they hung on to it for several years. They just couldn't bring themselves to throw their wedding video away. Her husband one time was driving by our store and thought, they repair CDs and DVDs. I wonder what they can do with my tape. And stopped in and asked. We said, bring it in. So he brought it in, and we were able to totally restore it because the shell itself was past a flash point and had melded. But we could cut all the shell away from it and get the tape and put it in a new case. And we're able to play it. We recovered the entire tape.
Really? Oh, they had to be thrilled. All right, flooding.
First, what you do not want to do, and I've had disaster places do this with their stuff. They tell people, oh, put it in the freezer. No. They say, because it'll keep soaking into the item. But so if you freeze, it'll stop the soaking. Yeah, but the freezing can crack it. And then when you thought, the water's back there again anyway.
Right, the expansion, right?
Exactly.
And contraction, it'll damage the paper especially.
Exactly. That is so true. And so what I suggest you do is get sheets of wax paper and put those between every one of your pictures because that'll keep them from sticking to each other while they dry. And then take them to a place like us or any professional photo lab, especially ones that do their own film developing, because they can re-wet them and run them through their drum dryer, and it'll make a nice, clear, shiny coat on them again and make them just like brand new.
Well, and you know, I had this happen with the photographs that I had damaged. I had three pictures signed by the Apollo 11 astronauts. Yeah, valuable. And they had all these wrinkles in them from the flood. And they were actually able to take them and reintroduce some moisture that flattened them, and then they steamed it out, and they went completely flat, and then they were able to put it on a backing, which was acid-free, and they're just like new. They are fabulous.
Oh, it's amazing technology. So many things. Whenever you're in a disaster and you think there's no way out of this, make a few phone calls. Google some things. There's almost always you can fix things. The technology now is so amazing. But yeah, they use this big dryer that's super polished chrome, and so when they put the picture on it, it will, you know, adhere to the chrome, and then it'll peel right off when it's fully dry. And they have all different kinds of things like that. You can buy them yourself. But I really wouldn't recommend it unless you're a closet photographer and have done your own developing and such. Like I grew up on that in high school. Take it to a professional. Don't mess around with it. Don't just throw it away. Think, oh,
yeah,
I can't use this.
Don't throw it away. Whatever you do, there might be a way it can be rescued. I was thrilled because it took about a dozen years before I finally stumbled onto the fact that they could fix each picture for about $2. And the value that it added back to this was thousands.
Oh, yeah, because it's not a hard process. It's not a time-consuming process, so they can do it pretty inexpensive. So don't assume this is some big expensive thing. Ask around if it's too expensive. Just store them for a while, because maybe one day down the road when you hit the lottery, you'll be able to have them all done. So don't ever throw stuff away, even if they look really, really bad. Because a lot of times you can scan these later on with special scanners that do ultraviolet light, and they can actually pick up stuff that has been washed away and restore it in Photoshop.
This is great advice, and I hope everybody remembers this, especially if they're ever in this situation. Good stuff, Tom.
Yeah, we're coming into hurricane and tornado season, so, you know, buckle down.
Thanks, Tommy. See you next week. Thanks once again to Dennis Brimhall, the CEO and president of Family Search International, for his insight on where we are and where we're going with family history research over the next many years. And of course, if you missed any of that interview, you want to catch the podcast on our website, extremegenes.com, or on iTunes or through iHeartRadio. I am Fisher. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.